Hey, y'all, welcome back to the show. Well, I mean, from yesterday. Welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Oh, I better turn it down a bit there. Think my mic's a little hot. I must have bumped it with my elbow bone. How's it sound now, Ma? All right. Yeah, welcome to it. It's the show. I'm Scott Horton, the host of it. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. An interview show. I ask questions. Well, I kind of give long rambling statements and then ask my guest to either correct me where I'm wrong or elaborate from there or whatever kind of thing. I won't say I got the best form, but I've got impeccable taste in guests. For example, Grant F. Smith is going to be back on the show today. Where the hell has he been? I'm sure he's been doing what he's been doing all along. What the hell's the matter with me? Why haven't I been interviewing Grant Smith? Well, he's back. And if you're familiar with Grant Smith, then what you're familiar with is that, oh yeah, he's really good on Israel being bad in the USA. That's what he is. In fact, in a sense, you could call Jason Leopold his counterpart in that they both just sue the government all day for documents. Give us the documents. FOIA this and FOIA that. And yeah, here's the fee. Give me the paperwork. And both of them are really great reporters along those lines. They do a lot of great work that way. And geez, you know, I think that you could probably call them unparalleled, except for they're parallel with each other when it comes to just that type of research. Anyway, especially on the lines of Israel, Grant F. Smith is going to be here today, and you'll see what I mean if you don't already know. And then Letta Taylor, she is, let me get it right now. Give me a minute. She's from Human Rights Watch. She's not trying to monger us into a war, so breathe easy. This is complaining about one of the wars. Mostly Yemen, but I guess it is Yemen. Anyway, about the drone strikes. And man, I did not, I spent too much time goofing off on Facebook today. I work much better at the last minute, you know? And I spent too much time goofing off, and I really meant to go and review all of these stories I got about the drones. I did read her piece, though, at Foreign Policy. I did not get a chance to read the report. But anyway, she wrote the report, and she wrote an article about it. So, yeah. Maybe it was the Human Rights Watch did the Yemen report, and Amnesty did the Pakistan report. Is that it? Yeah. See, now I know what I'm talking about. Well, it's better than screwing that up on the introduction, right? Okay, good. You know, I always wondered about that. Sorry, I'm just talking to myself. You happen to be listening. Okay, yeah, and then, I already said Jason Leopold's going to be here. Right? So, by definition, that's a good show. Grant Smith, Letta Taylor, and Jason Leopold. And now I got so much news, and I'm going to try to time this out by just going fast, because even just in categories, I got so much news. I'm going to try so hard to not talk about it and just mention it and move on. You guys know where you can find it. Well, I'll tell you where you can find it. But there's just so much going on. So first of all, in the drone war section, there is this pair of new reports, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty, Yemen and Pakistan. And there's this piece, I think they're linking to this at antiwar.com, maybe yesterday or something. I'm behind. But it's an 8-year-old girl, Pakistani girl, on drones. When they fly overhead, I wonder, will I be next? And I was just thinking, hey, that's evil! What in the hell? That's my commentary on that. terrorizing little children. That's what red, white, and blue and USA and all that means to the young of the world. Jeez, I guess I cross my fingers and hope they don't shoot a Hellfire missile at me, because that's all I can do. And there's the thing is about these two reports is they've generated a lot of good writing too. At antiwar.com, at McClatchy Newspapers, at The Guardian, at CNN, they have in the SWAT Valley, U.S. drone strikes radicalizing a new generation. Of course, this ties in with the NSA stories. One of the most recent ones, which was beautifully critiqued by Chris Floyd at the Empire Burlesque blog, which I'd urge you to read, but it's by Barton Gellman at the Washington Post, and it's about the NSA and their electronic war against the tribal territories and the SWAT Valley and all of that, and some of their assassinations. And anyway, Chris Floyd sure is great too. But anyway, so what do you expect to happen? You know, you kill a bunch of people, create a bunch more enemies, and most of whom can't get here from there, but still. Also, it's wrong, you know, killing old ladies and little kids. You know, I don't know, man. You've seen enough movies. It's not hard to imagine what it would be like. Hell, all you're doing is imagining your own future, your own not-too-distant future. To imagine what it would be like to have Predator and Reaper drones flying all around in your neighborhood. Only, I think in America, maybe they'll arm them with, you know, God help us, just regular rifles. Not Hellfire missiles. Not at first, Scott. We gotta work up to Hellfire missiles inside, you know, American borders. But we'll get there. But, okay, anyway, squeeze your eyes shut really tight and use your imagination and think of Reaper drones flying around in your neighborhood. For real, in real life. Flying around your neighborhood, armed with missiles, and occasionally killing whoever is on the other side of the remote control says to kill every once in a while, seemingly at random as far as you can tell. And you're trying to raise kids in that. Or be a kid. Or be a full-grown man or woman. What the hell is that? You know, I've told you this before, but I'll tell you it again. The Washington Post, I know it's the Washington Post. Yeah, yeah, everybody roll your eyes. The Washington Post did a wonderful story about the Israeli drone war against the children of the Gaza Strip. You know, the majority of the people in Gaza are minors. Anyway, so Israel's drone war against them. And the thing is, you have to read through 1,000 words of poor little Israel has no choice. They're helpless before the children of Gaza, who would push them all into the sea. Don't cry. Just wait. Because when you get to word number 1001, oh, then they start telling the truth about the Israeli drone war against the children of Gaza. And it's horrifying. And the thing about it is, it's very well written. And it gets across, you know, subtle understandings and ideas and things that I can't really convey to you right now because I ain't that clever or nothing but well-spoken or anything. But they really kind of get you into the mind of a Gazan child who has to run across the street from this house to that house and has to wonder every time if it's the last time he'll ever go outside or whether his entire body is about to be torn apart by an Israeli with a joystick far away somewhere. And what it's really like to live that way. I don't remember what it was called, but you know what? It's the 21st century. Use your Google search terms. Washington Post, Gaza, drones. I don't know. Nightmare. Something like that. Maybe poor little helpless Israel has to do it. Throw that in there. I'm sure Google will fetch it right up for you. Yeah, here was the one about the grandmother. You know, Reuters has this thing now where they're refreshing every page and putting it back to the front page of Reuters.com. So every Reuters story I have for you, including the one I just clicked on, it automatically refreshed as soon as I clicked on it. It was about the grandmother who was blown apart by a drone. You know, not that Pakistanis are human beings and, You know, it isn't like they mind when somebody kills their grandmother, you know, tears her body apart with superheated shrapnel, traveling at the speed of sound and all. Would you really care if somebody blew your grandmother up? Probably not, right? What do they care? Right? It's fine. Life is cheap over there in Asia and stuff like that, I heard somewhere. They don't care if you kill their grandmother. Go ahead and kill their grandmother. Besides, it's the Democrats doing it. So, I mean, what are you going to do? They're as good as it gets when it comes to killing people with high explosives. And I'm sorry, because this is the subject matter of the whole interview. I'm wasting time talking about drones. I'll let her talk about drones. I'm going to try to shut my mouth about drones and let her talk when it's her turn. Here, Reuters, they've screwed me again and refreshed my page. But the story is, here it is. Saudi Arabia warns of shift away from U.S. over Syria and Iran. And we talked about that a little bit with Charles Featherstone yesterday about how they declined a seat on the UN Security Council, which, man, how often does that ever happen? Must have been a while since anybody ever did that. But the reason it's really important is training of Syrian insurgents steps up in Saudi Arabia. And this is at Jane's Defense Weekly. And you know what? I don't know. But I'd be willing to bet that if I went over to the Moon of Alabama blog, that they're already explaining how this is all a smokescreen and how America and Syria are working together to step the whole thing up rather than there's a real split here. But I don't know. And I would probably go with that because I'm sure, well, they make good cases for the cases they make there. I like that blog. I don't read it often enough. Moon of Alabama, it's called. Anyway, they've been really good on Syria. So they're just training up more and more Mujahideen in Saudi Arabia to send off to Syria. And, you know, so the theory is that Prince Bandar is really angry at Barack Obama for backing off the airstrikes and full-scale intervention in the Syrian war. Sorry, I had to drink some soda. I like it. It's got sugar. Tastes sweet. But so there you go. I mean, and then that'll just mean that Iraq and Iran and Hezbollah are going to step up their support for the Assad government there. I mean, I don't know what it would take to really change the momentum in the Syrian war, but it's been on the side of the government there all along, and I don't see any real reason that's going to change. And it also looks like, you know, never mind what he wants to do about it, that basically Bandar is right, that Barack Obama has backed down. And so he's made a deal with Putin where if you get the chemical weapons out of the country, then we won't bomb. Well, but that also means, in effect, sort of, kind of, and I'm not saying they couldn't take it back, like an Indian treaty or whatever. I'm just saying what they're saying is we'll never bomb. Because when Obama ad-libbed this stupid red line, it was if they use chemical weapons. Well, so if they have no chemical weapons to even use, then at that point, at least in theory, there's basically nothing else that Assad could do to get attacked by the U.S. at this point, at least outright. And I think it would take a pretty significant intervention in order to really tip the scales. But the thing of it is, as we've talked about all along, as now more and more is common knowledge, it used to really be ignored, but it's more and more common knowledge. The rebels here are the guys who were the bad guys in the Iraq War, at least the resistance to the Americans and the Iranians, really, and the Iraqi traitors who'd been living in Iran for 30 years. From the Supreme Islamic Council, the Badr Brigades. That's who this is. The guys that, out of 4,500 Americans that died in the thing, a good 3,000-something were killed by these guys. Same groups. And I think people are finally getting a handle on that, and I think, You know, I don't know, man. Sometimes it's easy to imagine that, you know, very intelligent, very, you know, in touch, very powerful people run everything. But a lot of times I think that, you know, these Samantha Powers running around, they really are the power of the state. And they really are as dumb as they look. I mean, you couldn't help but understand that about George W. Bush, right? This guy really is as dumb as he looks. So when Samantha Power says, oh, we have to help the people, is she really just an agent of the Likud Party of Israel? Which would be, you know, the intelligent, real politics, what's going on here kind of a thing, that the Israelis want to smash all their neighboring Arab states into warring tribes so that nobody ever has a state that can threaten them again. Or does she really think that, yeah, what we'll do is we'll just back the Northern Storm Brigade instead of the al-Nusra Front, and then it'll be fine? Or what? Stupidity or the plan? Obviously, it's a little bit of both. Obviously, they only fail in their own interest. Well, not only. Not exclusively, but a lot of the time. But anyway, I think at this point, even, I mean, can you imagine the White House conversation about this? You got John Kerry and Samantha Power and Susan Rice and these ladies sitting around, and you got Barack Obama sitting there, and they're going, yeah, we got to intervene on the side of Al-Qaeda more and better. I mean, what is he supposed to do, really? You know? I mean, George Bush handed the Sunni area of Iraq over to the bin Ladenites, basically. Not that they have total control there or whatever. He sure to create a giant Mujahideen training ground in the Sunni triangle there to this day for 10 years running, and now they're exporting it. They've been exporting it. They've been going back home where they're from and causing new problems. Look at Libya and Syria. But geez, the war was really outright on behalf of Iran, huh? So that makes it an altogether different kind of treason. George Bush only helped Al-Qaeda accidentally. Here America's backing them. But I think Obama's position on this has got to be, no, man, I can't go down in history. I might go down in history as horrible in every way, but, man, I don't want to be the guy that actually handed Syria over to bin Ladenites, to people who had sworn their loyalty to Zawahiri. Can I really do that? Do I really want that? And it is up to him. It is up to him. Don't let him, you know, squeal, or that's not the right word, you know, slither out of his responsibility by just saying he's a figurehead, this, that, whatever. He's the one in the chair. And in fact, if you listen to Hillary ratting him out, she's saying, yeah, we wanted to back Al-Qaeda more, and he didn't. He was the one, the president himself was the one who put the brakes on Hillary, Panetta, and Petraeus last year on going full force. This year is John Kerry, and although I don't know if Hagel was really on board for it. I mean, he was on board for it, but I guess in private he must have been counseling at least caution or something. But anyway, I mean, if you were even the worst person in the world, i.e. the president of the United States, would you outright back Al-Qaeda? Even if that's what Netanyahu and all the Republicans and the Democrats and the Congress demanded. Because they're not the ones who are going to go down in history with their name on the policy forever, you know? I mean, maybe that's just me. That might just be me, actually. The politicians, I guess they're good with it. Geneva in doubt, the rebels aren't going to show up. Suicide bombings across Syria. Oh, but here's what I was going to say, and I just flipped away. Good news from Syria, really. Chemical weapons are being dismantled on schedule. It's working. So, that's Obama's policy. Just keep Assad. Right? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In the war state, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The war state could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right. Hey, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. Like I say, Grant Smith, Letta Taylor, and Jason Leopold are coming up on the show. That'll be good. So, the rebels aren't going to show up in Geneva. That's what the point. Other than this, the chemical weapons removal is moving ahead on schedule, and that's extremely important. I don't know if there... maybe there can be a peace deal, as Phil Giraldi put it, you know, just deal with everybody but the ones who won't show up and do your best to marginalize them after that if you can. I don't know. But, you know, I don't always agree with Bob Baer, but I saw him on TV a few months back saying, before all the, you know, supposed attacks, maybe the first rumored chemical weapons attacks in Syria would have been half a year ago or more. And he was saying, hey, look, I know these guys, the Alawites, I know them very, very well. And that's a fact. I mean, he probably knows them better than any American. The leaders, the rulers of Syria. He's a former CIA guy. And he's the guy, Syriana, the movie Syriana is about him with Clooney. Anyway, he said, listen, they would use chemical weapons if it came down to it. You're damn right, because they know. And he wasn't saying, because I'm here to spread propaganda for regime change. It was, in this case, he was saying, because, hey, what they face if they lose is a beheading. For real. And they know it. And so if it comes to using gas on somebody, hell yeah, they will. And I think that that's probably true. I'd use gas on somebody if they're going to cut my head off, wouldn't you? I could probably not gas their whole neighborhood, but geez. Anyway. Lucky I wasn't a Syrian. But point being, so now, even with their back to the wall, they won't be able to use chemical weapons. The red line for intervention on behalf of the Al-Qaeda Mujahideen guys that Bandar is sending, it won't be there. They can't do it, I think. I mean, something else could change. And if Obama has the support of the American people, he can. I mean, assuming he wants to, maybe I should say, under the pressure of the American people, Obama could make a nuclear deal with Iran. And Sheldon Richman at FFF.org, his article for the 23rd is, does Obama have the courage to pursue peace with Iran? And that is the question, because it is going to take... a lot of political will here at home. And the Republicans do stand in his way, although I will direct you toward antiwar.com today or yesterday or someday recently. There was this piece at Foreign Policy that says that Obama actually has waiver capacity on many, if not all, these sanctions. And in fact, he's really the one in charge of enforcing them anyway. So if he really had to tell Congress to shut up and back off, that he was going to list some sanctions in order to get an additional protocol signed, et cetera, like that, then he could do it. But he will have a fight against the leaders of both parties in Congress and in both houses, too. You know, all the domestic politics, 75% of the American people want to see these nuclear talks. But 90% of the political power is against it. Well, I don't know about 90%, but a lot. I think there are a lot of people who are sick and tired of this, too. They gotta be. But Anyway, it's going to be a fight, so it's not quite as much of an emergency. It doesn't feel like or seem like as they're trying to start bombing Syria this week. Call your congressman, stop them. Go to the town hall and stop them, right? It's just talks. But to me, it's just as important. I think it should be just as important. And of course, if they can make a real nuclear deal with Iran, that'd just be the first step toward normalizing relations, possibly anyway. Toward normalizing relations, repealing eventually all the sanctions, and, you know, recognizing Iran as, you know, a frenemy, China style. We're friends and trading partners, but we're not best friends and allies and whatever. Go buy your planes from the Russians instead of us or whatever. You know, look at a map and look at Persia. That's a big enough state with a long enough history. And I even mean just from 79, never mind ancient history and all of that, that, you know, come on, what are you going to do, dude? It's not like this is just, you know, Mexico. You have to run roughshod all over them and make them fight a massive civil war over cocaine distribution? Really? And kill 50,000 people and whatever? I mean, hey, they're a proud nation. You got to respect their independence, even if you don't love it. And if we can normalize relations with them, then that changes everything as far as Syria. And you know what? This is what's best for Israel anyway. Israel's like a screaming baby in this who are being told, could be told by their American parents to cool it. You know? Eat your vegetables. I'm so sick of Netanyahu, I could puke blood. Anyway, I told you yesterday, signs of rift. That's the ABC News headline. Are hawks in Congress trying to scuttle Iran talks on behalf of Israel? That's at the Prospect. Senators vow to defy Obama on Iran sanctions. That's at antiwar.com. And then the Reuters, I'm sure as soon as I click on it, they're going to refresh on me. U.S. Israel differ on how to resolve Iran nuclear issue, something like that. I don't know why. When I clicked on it, it took me to the front page. You want me to keep my tabs open, guys, or what? I might click back on your tab if you let me keep it open. Anyway, yeah, so there's your rift. The Iranians make a offer to the Americans, and the Israelis reject it. So if 75% of the American people want these nuclear talks and a resolution to this so-called bogus crisis in the first place anyway, but if that's what 75% of the American people want, and the Israelis and their fifth column of sock puppets in Washington, D.C., and yeah, I mean the Congress and all the think tanks except two, if they're against it, then what does it take? Could this be the thing that turns the American people against the Israel lobby and against the Israeli state? We don't want any more crises over there. If we can make a deal with Iran that'll extra double super verify their non-diversion of nuclear material that's been verified all this time, their non-diversion, then let's do that. I'm sick of these stupid Israelis, man. Oh, you know who else is sick of the stupid Israelis? Grant Smith, coming up next on the show. Huh? That's not what it's supposed to play. Boy, I got errors in my bumper music today, guys. I mean, I guess I'm glad it's playing. I like it. Why are there two outros in a row? Something screwy with me and the Zara radio program. I'll tell you what. I blame me more than the program. All right. Is anything else going to play? No. FusePowder.com. Audible trial. Oh, here we go. Fail. Double fail. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Sorry for the horribly botched bottom of the hour break there. I don't know what the hell happened. Well, I keep having to update commercials. I take some out, I add some, I change bumper musics a little bit, and then, you know, okay, I clearly screwed up pretty bad there. All right, anyway. Time for our first guest. It's the great Grant F. Smith from EarMep. And that's not ear like your ear. It's IRMEP. IRMEP.org. EarMep, that's the... I used to always have it on the tip of my tongue.
Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy.
You know what? I had that on the tip of my tongue 6 seconds ago, and then it went away. Thank you. God, welcome back to the show, Grant. It's been way too long.
Yeah, it's great to be back. I hope it hasn't been too long.
No, it has. It's been way too long, I says.
Okay.
I mean it. Hey, so I love this thing that you wrote. I wish everyone in America would read it, and then I think they'd think more like me. About America's relationship with Israel. It's 10 explosive U.S. government secrets about Israel. And
yeah.
I don't think that's really too hyperbolic of you to say explosive there. Some of these are literally such, and all of them are really horrible, and all of them completely buried, and you don't even include number 11 on the dial. On the PA, which of course would be the USS Liberty. But anyway, I'm going to be quiet as much as I can and just let you tell these stories. I'll only interrupt if I think I absolutely have to follow up something here. But please go ahead and start us off. We got half an hour to go through your list here.
All right. Well, let me start from the bottom of the list because it's one that I haven't worked on at all. But I know that you've talked about it. It's the revelation broadcast by Glenn Greenwald, facilitated by Edward Snowden, which is that the United States is funneling intercepts, NSA intercepts, on Americans to Israel. And, you know, just finding that out makes anyone ask a simple question, which is, I didn't know about that. Who authorized that? You know, if that kind of thing is going on, what else is going on?
Yeah.
And the purpose of this piece is to really lay it out with evidence, with links to the Freedom of Information Act filings, to the mandatory declassification review attempts of secret documents, and even the latest attempt to get the highest body in the declassification world, the Interagency Security Classifications Appeals Panel, called the ISCAP, to release documents. And what you find is that there are a lot of secrets. There are a lot of toxic, explosive secrets that if only Americans had any idea about what happened, what their history actually was, they would take action. They would become people who could give advised consent as opposed to just consent. And so, you know, it was an inspiration to see the Snowden release, and it made me want to get out some of the work that we've been doing over the past decade to let people know there's a lot more going on than anyone even realized.
Here's one of the parts where I absolutely have to interrupt you, and that is just to tell the people how important your website is and the work that you do. Again, IRMEP.org, the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. Just pages and pages. I don't know how many thousands of pages of documents of your digging. I mean, this is the real digging through the weeds here for the primary source material.
Right, right.
Truck loads full of it.
Yeah, and particularly a section of the website called the Israel Lobby Archive, where we've done some groundbreaking work on just gathering documents about how the U.S. Middle East policy is really determined behind the scenes in terms of lots of Israel lobbying groups and American presidents and other interest groups coming together, including law enforcement at times, in a vast collision. So it's a real look behind the scenes. And we try to add to that document store. What I found is that in most cases, nobody else is really trying to get a lot of this stuff declassified. And the problem with it is that a lot of the information gradually disappears. It becomes what Rumsfeld would call unknown unknowns, stuff that has been forgotten, destroyed, purposely destroyed at times due to document retention policies, et cetera, et cetera. So we're trying to save history in many cases. And the first instance here was trying to get FBI files on Henry Morgenthau Jr. Now, this is FDR's Treasury Secretary. He's most known for wanting to dismember Germany after World War II, return it to a pastoral state, as he and others have said, instead of the more constructive Marshall Plan for Reconstruction. But he was involved in, according to secondhand accounts, a lot of activities related to arming fighters in Palestine to fight for a Jewish state. And some even claim that he was involved in helping finance nuclear weapons research and weapons building by charitable donations and things like that.
What year did Israel get the bomb, by the way?
Well, it looks like they had it by the mid-1960s. It looks as though by 65 or 66, they were able to assemble simple gun-type weapons using uranium that was actually stolen from the United States.
And Hiroshima bomb, in other words,
We don't have a lot of the CIA's most closely held pieces of intelligence about that for some reasons I'll get into later. But anyway, there's a 10,000-page file full of intercepts. It's a counterintelligence file. It's about Morgenthau, and the National Archives, the FBI, have gone through it, and they've now claimed that they have declassified it. And every single page, almost every page, is blanked out. So, it's up on the website. People can take a look. Just once again, search for this by article title, 10 Explosive U.S. Government Secrets About Israel, and you'll see that even this World War II era document, the government does not think Americans are fit, not ready to see that yet. The second one's Eisenhower and the Affair.
We got to skip the second one and come right back to it, but we got to go to number three because you just mentioned it already, and I think if people were listening close, they went, wait, what did he just say now again? How much uranium did Israel steal from the United States, and which current prime ministers of Israel were in on that?
Yeah, right. Well, Netanyahu, it turns out, in some documents that we had released last year, came out on July 4, was involved in the smuggling ring that was taking Krytrons, which can be used as nuclear triggers, out of the United States. He's clearly named in the FBI documents. But the bigger case here, which is called the diversion from Apollo or the NUMEC incident, is something the CIA has developed thousands of pages about, because they were told to investigate the Americans and the Israelis involved in smuggling weapons-grade material, 339 kilograms, out of Apollo, Pennsylvania's plant. This was government-owned uranium, by the way, from a contractor, into Dimona. And there is quite compelling evidence that's come from all sorts of government agencies, including the fact that samples were picked up with the signature of the same type of uranium that came from Apollo, picked up outside of Dimona. But the most recent news on getting any of this, these thousands of CIA files out, is a blanket denial that we received this year, which cites a previous blanket denial, which was given in 1979 by John Stein, who is CIA Deputy Director for Operations, in which he said basically in English that in order to release any of this, there'd have to be coordination with the president, and also could be some problems with the Israelis, which they see as a valuable liaison equity. So it's really up to the a president and the Israelis to let the CIA disclose this, or at least that's how we're interpreting it. But people can see that as point number three. Basically, this is absolutely incredible. You know, thousands of documents detailing exactly what happened at the CIA, and they will not release any of them. So that's pretty bad. Moving back to Eisenhower and the Levon affair. Okay, so Eisenhower.
This one is just as shocking to me, and is probably just as unknown as the theft of the nuclear material, too.
Sure. Well, and it's going to stay that way, because maybe people don't know this, but the Eisenhower Presidential Archive in Kansas apparently doesn't have enough resources to process his files. And although the archivist and other people write books about Eisenhower, authors write books about Eisenhower, the archivist can say that they don't actually know what his reaction was when they found out in 1954 that the Israelis had launched a false flag attack on U.S. facilities in Egypt, trying to frame the Egyptians, but they were caught by the Egyptians and prosecuted and hung. And what lessons did Eisenhower learn about all of this, especially as he was, you know, constantly being swarmed by lobbyists from the American Zionist Council and the founder of AIPAC, who's pictured in at the very far left in the article, constantly meeting with him, asking for money and support? Well, support for a country that attacks you and tries to frame frame Egypt. So they have not been able to find any documents. They've released some National Security Council memos in which Ike expressed his low opinion of some of his counterparts, but they've never actually released any information about what he thought about this attack. And I think that would be very informative, particularly when we get further on into the Niger uranium forgeries.
Yeah. Wait, by the way, can you be a little bit more specific about what actually happened, the Israelis and how they got busted? Was it just cutouts, or were they actual Mossad officers, or what was the deal?
They were Jewish Egyptians who were in Egypt, and they were sent to attack American information agency facilities, such as libraries and other sort of goodwill public diplomacy type facilities, dressed as Arabs, so that the United States would think that Egypt was a place where they had to maintain troops and an international presence in particularly the Suez Canal zone, which was becoming and still is, of course, a lifeline of international commerce, particularly energy coming up through the Arab Gulf, Persian Gulf area. So they failed when some of their explosives went off early, and they were arrested and all thrown into a jail. One of them committed suicide. Israel denied that these were their false flag operatives for years and years, until something like 2005, when they were all given national medals of honor, the surviving ones. And so this was a thorn in the side of Israel's reputation in the United States, and it even led later on in the early 1960s led the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to think about, well, if the Israelis are trying to tripwire us into this type of response, you know, maybe we should look into their lobbying arms in the United States and make sure they're not continually doing that to us. So it was a very important event, and it's astounding. It's just astounding that Eisenhower has no known written analysis of what this implied for U.S.-Israel relations.
How big of a news story was it back then, if at all? Do you know?
Not a very big news story. It's very, very difficult to find clippings. The AIPAC newsletter mentions it, surprisingly. The Near East Report, when it refers to a problem it was having, it has an article titled "Another Explosion," and it, you know, kind of doesn't really talk too much about the terrorist attacks, but you could see just how important it was to the lobbying organizations and sort of their internal house organs. But like a lot of things, like the Numek affair, in fact, the reporting is bad. Like the Crytron heist, the reporting is bad. Thomas Friedman's article about the Crytrons claims unconvincingly that, you know, they can also serve as soup timers. So, you know, one common denominator in a lot of the establishment media reporting about this type of stuff is that if they do report on it, it's astonishingly deceptive. But normally they choose not to report on it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you mentioned the Niger uranium forgeries. And so I want to get to Iraq and Iran here in a minute. But since we're jumping around anyway, let's talk about Jonathan Pollard here.
Okay.
And, and Cap Weinberger.
Yeah. So Jonathan Pollard was, you know, detected by a fellow. He was a naval contractor, naval intelligence, worker, and he was detected. He was basically pilfering Defense Intelligence Agency files for some of the most sensitive things the U.S. had going, such as the RAISE and the communications manual, all the spectrum and monitoring that was going on around the world and funneling it to the Israelis. He had always considered, since going to Israel in a Weizmann Institute camp, summer camp, he had always claimed to his friends that he was going to become an Israeli spy, and he finally did become one. And he had kind of an attitude. When he was finally indicted, he basically claimed that he believed it was the established policy, and this is quoting him, of the Department of Justice not to prosecute American citizens for espionage as long as it was on behalf of Israel, and was extremely surprised when Caspar Weinberger issued a classified briefing to the sentencing judge that made him the exception to that rule and gave him a life sentence. And so the process of
it sounds like a pretty fair defense he was offering, right? They're like, hey, everybody does it. What are you talking about? Why am I the bad guy here?
He was offering, if he hadn't said that, he might have gotten the same deal that people like Abraham Feinberg got, Nahum Bernstein, the same deal that Hank Greenspan, the arms smuggler, got, Al Schwimmer. I mean, there were a host of other people who he was undoubtedly familiar with who had been major smugglers and spies who never got any penalty for their activities. In fact, were rewarded for it handsomely. It was a fair assessment of the situation, but Caspar Weinberger told the judge something that made him give Pollard a life sentence. Now, you know, the amount of rigmarole that the Defense Department went through when we tried to get that classified sentencing memorandum has been incredible. They finally said the Justice Department owns it. We don't own it, even though the DOD produced it. And the Executive Office of U.S. Attorneys says, hey, you know what? We can't find our copy. We're not going to ask DOD for their copy. And we're not going to walk two blocks over to court to get a copy. You know, I've been within 10 feet of this document. It's locked in a safe in the district court. And I'm sure it would be very good to know if, as many people suspect, many people with security clearances suspect, that the reason he got a harsh sentence was that Israel was passing all this information to the Soviets so it could get more immigrants to Israel at this particular moment. I mean, it fits the time. It fits the activities that the Israelis are engaged in. But we can't know because some executive office employees at the attorney's office won't walk over to court and begin a declassification process. So we probably will never see that Jonathan Pollard, of course, is slated to be released fairly soon, having served the majority of his sentence, which, you know, life is not exactly life anymore. So that's a very interesting document we can't get. But getting into the overall theme of Israeli spies, you really can't get information on any Israeli spy. You know, you can get a lot of information on Anna Chapman. She was arrested in 2010. She was sent to Russia. You can get it on American spies who spied for other countries, such as Robert Hansen. You can get a lot of information from the FBI about their prosecutions or diligent investigations of any spy, as long as it's not an Israeli spy. And that's rather interesting. In fact, I put up some FOIA responses. The FBI wanted us to get Rafael Eitan, who is probably the biggest, most destructive Israeli spy ever to target America, wanted us to get his signature on a Privacy Act waiver before they gave us his voluminous file. They told us Hurricane Sandy prevented them from finding Ben-Ami Kadesh, who was working at the same time Jonathan Pollard was, getting his file. And basically, Avraham Ermoni, a big nuclear spy who targeted all sorts of U.S. nuclear technology, they won't release a single page about any Israeli spy. And worse than that, in our other FOIA activity, we've detected that they've really stopped prosecuting them as well. Stuart Nozette, who was working on all sorts of contracts with Israel Aircraft Industries, but simultaneously passing classified information, they designed a separate sting operation to take him down and thereby avoided embarrassing Israel. Telegy, which was smuggling nuclear equipment, 2007 to 2010, they simply had an industry regulator fine them and punish them, but didn't actually engage in a criminal investigation, which they should have done. So you've got this sort of double standard. They won't release information, and they're not actually even prosecuting spies for Israel anymore. And this is showing up in a lot of statistics, whereas, you know, Israel is previously ranked as a number one economic and national security defense threat. You can kind of see the results of non-prosecution trickling through those reports to Congress. They just don't show up anymore.
Mm. Yeah, and of course, every time they get away with it, it's just a permission slip to keep doing it, too.
Right, and you've had former FBI and justice officials on your show. Was it Cole who has said there's a huge stack of unprosecuted Israeli spies?
I believe he said 150 cases that he knew of where they were prosecutable but not prosecuted.
Right. The Justice Department's licked. I mean, they haven't been able to bring a successful case. They get bombarded internally, externally, beaten up by the press. Pretty much if you indict an Israeli spy, the world comes down on your head. You know, it just doesn't, they just don't do it anymore, basically. Number six, there's a tape that the FBI has with Steve Rosen's and Keith Weissman's voice trying to convince a Washington Post reporter, Glenn Kessler, that Iran was engaged in total war against the United States inside Iraq, which of course means that back in 2004, 2005, the United States should have immediately attacked Iran, or at least that's the story they were selling. They were trying to use purloined classified information to make that convincing argument. They were being wiretapped by the FBI. The FBI played the tape to AIPAC's legal counsel, Nathan Lewin, and we've been trying to get it ever since, and they won't give it to us. So even as AIPAC tries to get us into Syria, we still can't listen to their arguments for trying to get us into Iran. I would like to listen to those arguments. I'd like to see how AIPAC and its buddies in the establishment press work.
Well, and the story wasn't it, that the documents that they got were documents describing the internal discussions between Bush, Cheney, and Rice and the leadership, and that was helping them to create the spin that they wanted to figure out, you know, which wires to pull, sort of thing.
Right. They had decision documents. They had documents about the bombing of Khobar Towers that they wanted to leverage into grist for war. But
which was an Al-Qaeda attack, and they're liars, but sorry.
Yeah, exactly. And so the categorization that I'm giving, though, is the one that Steve Rosen gave during his depositions for a subsequent defamation suit. He was very clear saying, you know, I positioned it as total war. You know, I was talking to get them to write a story about this. And so the information I'm giving is really his account of what was going on. We know they were also very closely tied to Israeli diplomats, that they're meeting on a weekly basis and sharing information, tasking Lawrence Franklin to get more information. So everything in the bigger file makes it look like a very comprehensive, you know, espionage effort designed to trigger a U.S. war on Iran, basically. But, you know, the simple fact of the matter is the two were indicted. The process never came to any real conclusion in the terms of an acquittal. The two were never acquitted. The prosecution was simply quashed when the Obama administration came into office, and suddenly it was gone. As I mentioned, the same year that Obama began shoveling all of this all of these wiretaps over via the NSA to Israel. So there's a real nasty point of analysis you can make that he's simultaneously shutting down a warranted espionage prosecution and then even harnessing the power of the NSA to spy on Americans and shovel the intelligence to Israel. It's very suspicious. It's got to get a lot more analysis before he leaves office. But this tape should also be released. Rosen characterized it as sinister, something that made him look really bad, as though he were, you know, not the one who was talking on the wiretap. But I think Americans should be able to listen to this tap, and they can't because the Department of Justice doesn't think that even though they've played it for, you know, one member of the public, that the rest of the members of the public should be able to listen to it.
And now, listen, we're almost out of time here, so let me just set up real quick. There's a lot more we're not going to be able to cover here. But you don't mention, but I just wanted to set up the story of the Niger uranium thing and the possibility there that Bob Dreyfus in The Nation and Julian Borger in The Guardian both reported that there was an Office of Special Plans created in Ariel Sharon's office where they were manufacturing bogus intelligence in English to funnel straight into the intelligence stream, into the neocons, the stovepipe to the White House. And the Niger uranium forgeries, of course, seem to fit into that whole project. Of course, Stephen Hadley, a Dianwell neocon, admits he's the one who accepted the Niger uranium forgeries from the Italians and put them into the intelligence stream after the CIA had said no 14 times, I think.
Right, right. And Michael Ledeen's fingerprints are also all over this in the sense that the magazine Panorama that surfaced it and his involvement and connection to people directly involved. So the bottom line is there's a 1,000-page FBI investigation. And again, I've seen many of these investigative files, and they're usually quite illustrative or very interesting to read. But after beginning to declassify and release it, suddenly, we can't get it. They've denied it. So, you know, that's another thing. In the wake of Syria and the hype to attack Syria, people should at least know about this Niger investigation and what they found about these bogus forgeries.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember Steve Rosen complaining to, I guess, Haaretz, that the FBI was asking him, when they were interrogating him, they were asking him about, quote, every Jew in the Pentagon. And so the FBI they were looking at Douglas Feith. They were looking at who passed the fact that America had broken Iran's codes to Chalabi. And they were looking at all kinds of crimes that the neocons and the Office of Special Plans had committed there.
Yeah, that's his characterization of it. But the bottom line is he was probably upset because they wanted to flip him. And they said, hey, you need to talk to us.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, I wish they had flipped him, frankly. I wish they had been able to roll up this incredibly insidious network.
Yep. Me too. Hey, thanks for the time. I really appreciate it.
All right, Scott. Appreciate it.
All right, everybody. That is Grant F. Smith from IRMEP, IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. Hey, y'all. Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of the Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for the Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's the Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. We're on Liberty Express Radio, No Agenda Radio, and over at my website, scotthorton.org. By the way, I keep all my interview archives there at scotthorton.org. More than 3,000 now, going back to 2003. Next is Letta Taylor. She's a senior researcher on terrorism and counterterrorism at Human Rights Watch, with a focus on Yemen, and her latest report is Between a Drone and Al-Qaeda. And she's also got a piece in foreignpolicy.com, which is titled The Price of War. Welcome to the show, Letta. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And I really like this article. I admit I haven't had a chance to read the report, but I'm gonna. But I did read The Price of War at foreignpolicy.com. And I really do appreciate the way that you take the time to tell the personal stories of these individuals who are being killed, because I know just from my own experience that sometimes it's hard to imagine Yemen as anything but a vague shape on a map from far away somewhere rather than a real place where it seems like the earth is flat if you're standing there and everything is just like here, only there. And the people are all as human as can be from their head to their toes. And it's just, you know, TV doesn't really portray it that way. They never really give us any information. And a bird's eye view of the shape of Yemen on a map is hardly, you know, conveys much humanity. So, but your story sure does. And so I was hoping you could tell the people the story of those that you profile in here, the dead and their survivors, too.
Yes, well, thank you very much, and I think that's an excellent point because, in fact, President Obama has carried out an estimated 80 targeted killing operations in Yemen since 2009, yet he's only publicly acknowledged two of those strikes. Those are the ones that killed three American citizens. It's as if the hundreds of Yemenis killed in these attacks simply never existed. And so one of the things I set out to do, of course, was to determine who was being killed in these strikes, but also who were some of these Yemenis who were being killed. So not just numbers and lists, but why might they have been targeted or what went terribly wrong? And while the U.S. says it's doing all it can to protect civilians in these strikes, we did find in our research that the U.S. has killed innocent people in Yemen, dozens of them, if not more, and we'd like to know. So, I'm happy to tell some of these stories. You may need to cut me off at some point because there are many, but a couple that really jump out at me are two indiscriminate strikes, and these we call clear violations of the laws of war. One of them, the earliest strike in Yemen from 2009 on a hamlet called Al-Majla, involved cruise missiles and cluster munitions. These are indiscriminate weapons, and they showered hundreds of bomblets on an area. Well, the U.S. did kill 14 people they said were militants out to get the United States, but they also killed 41 Bedouins. These were shepherds sleeping in their tents, whose misfortune was that their only crime was they happened to be near the site where these militants were. And they were all sleeping at the time of the attack. To this day, the U.S. has not acknowledged that strike, and the only compensation that's been given for these 41 civilians who were killed, many of them women and children, was for the goats and beehives that they lost in the strike, nothing for the actual dead. So that's one case that really jumps out at me. Another one is a strike on a hamlet.
Let me follow up on that one real quick.
Yeah.
Do they specifically complain about that and point out that, oh, yeah, we get paid for our bees, but not for our father and our uncle? Or how does that work?
Yeah,
I mean, do they take it that way?
They have been fighting for almost 4 years now to get compensation for this strike. And the Yemeni government actually investigated the strike and determined that, yes, it was a ghastly accident. And they took the fall for it, although WikiLeaks later revealed that this was definitely a U.S. strike. And there's a table that WikiLeaks revealed in which U.S. officials, General Petraeus, in fact, speaking with a former president of Yemen, they describe how they're going to cover up the strike and make it sound like the Yemenis did it. And the former president of Yemen says, yeah, we'll say the bombs are ours, not yours. But, yeah, so the citizens, the families of those 41 Bedouins killed in the strike have been fighting since then for some kind of compensation. And the government of Yemen did offer them something for the dead loved ones killed, but it was a pitifully small sum. And the family said, no, we would like more. And the government would not give them more. Some of them just are so poor that reluctantly they then agreed to take some compensation for their goats, their sheep, and their beehives. But they're holding out, which gives you an idea of what the possessions are and the wealth of these people is. But they're holding out for real compensation for their loved ones.
Yeah, all right. Well, I just want to know. Specifically, it's not just, it sounds like insult to injury, but yeah, they sure take it that way too, just like you'd predict. So anyway, I'm sorry, because I did interrupt you and you were going to go on to the next one.
Oh. Well, so in another case that we examined, this was in a hamlet in central Yemen, a very tribal area with a lot of remote roads. A U.S. drone-assisted strike, probably by a warplane, struck a van on a remote stretch of road and killed all 12 of the 14 people inside. Well, it turned out that the 12 people inside that van were not al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. That's the Yemen-based group that is associated with al-Qaeda. No, in fact, the 12 people who were killed were civilians. They were subsistence farmers, their wives and children coming home from market. Their loved ones found them charred in pieces and dusted in flour and sugar that they were bringing home to their families. The target of that strike was nowhere in sight at that time. He was not in the vehicle. He was not on the road. So we're calling that an indiscriminate strike. Clearly, civilians were killed there. To this day, no apology from the U.S. government, no recognition. We've also found some strikes that are just clearly counterproductive. The one that I describe in the foreign policy piece is about a strike in southeast Yemen last year that killed three alleged members of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, but it also killed two civilians, one of whom happened to be a locally renowned cleric whose thing was to preach against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. That's what he did. He said, violence in the name of Islam is wrong. Now, this is precisely the kind of person who the U.S. Seeks to align with and to enlist, I mean, not literally enlist, but to join in their campaign to denounce violence by al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The reason this cleric was standing with the group of alleged militants was that the militants were looking for him after he gave a particularly vehement sermon denouncing al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And relatives were scared that if the cleric met with these three men who were strangers to that community, they came looking for him, relatives thought, don't go, we're worried, you should tone down your sermons, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is going to get you if you keep doing this. But in fact, if that was the intent of the militants, the U.S. got there first. The U.S. drones killed this anti-al-Qaeda cleric and his cousin, a policeman, one of the few policemen in this village, along with the militants. Now, everyone in that village has seen the photos or perhaps even seen the actual body parts of this cleric and his cousin after the strike, blown to pieces. The relatives only identified them by the belt on one and by a piece of beard on the other. And everyone went now in that village, when they see these photos, they think of America. So laws aside, there's a serious policy question here. Is the U.S. making more enemies than those that it is killing in these strikes? And that's why we think it's just absolutely imperative that the U.S. government start disclosing some basic facts. Who is it killing? How many of them are really militants? How many of them are civilians? What are you going to do about the civilians who you've killed unlawfully? And might you consider making amends to civilians you killed even in so-called acceptable strikes, lawful strikes, where there is collateral damage that's at an acceptable level? Even there, we think the U.S. should be compensating these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing of it. It's black ops covert action stuff, but it's only covert from the American people. There's nothing secret about it to the Yemenis. But that's basically their problem, right? They're hiding behind the fact that, hey, that's all classified. We're not officially at war with Yemen. We're just helping them clean up their bad guy problem a little.
Exactly. There is an accountability vacuum here. The secrecy has reached the level of the absurd because it's the biggest open secret in the world in Yemen that the U.S. is behind these strikes. It doesn't matter when the U.S. military, when the Yemeni military gets up and says, we carried out this strike or that strike. Everybody knows it's a lie. Why? Well, for one thing, most of these strikes take place at night, and the Yemeni Air Force cannot fly aircraft at night. They don't have the capacity or the training to do that. So it's pretty odd if the Yemeni government is accepting responsibility for strikes that occur at times it cannot fly, and particularly when you analyze the remnants, the ordnance of the weapons used, as we did in many of these cases, and discovered that in some cases they're cruise missiles and cluster munitions, which the Yemeni government doesn't have in its arsenal, and in other cases are Hellfire missiles, which are fired by U.S. drones, and the Yemenis also do not have Hellfires in their arsenal.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen pictures of some of this ordnance with American trademarks still written on the pieces.
Exactly, yeah. And we've identified exactly what kind of weapons they are, and they don't exist in Yemen unless somebody else is using them. So we know this is the U.S. We absolutely know it. And it's been admitted by U.S. officials off the record that they're the ones carrying out these strikes, as well as by Yemeni officials off the record. But nobody's going public on it. Obama has only in the most general terms admitted that the U.S. is carrying out these strikes. And when you add Pakistan into the picture, we're talking of hundreds of strikes that have killed thousands of people, and yet the U.S. will not say who it's killing. It's just simply as if these people don't exist.
Well, and even when they're kind of bragging about it, like in that big New York Times piece from, what I guess, May of 2012, where two or three dozen of the president's closest friends told his side of the story to the New York Times there. They even said, well, there are no civilians because anyone we kill is guilty by the fact that we killed them, unless the burden is on them to prove themselves innocent after we've killed them. And if they do, then we'll reclassify their corpse to not guilty. Something like that. I mean, they really said that, right? I'm paraphrasing not too roughly.
Yeah, I don't recall that exact phrase, but here's one of our big concerns is that, and this is one reason we want to know how many people the U.S. has killed and how many it is classifying as legitimate military targets, because we are concerned that the U.S. is using an extremely elastic definition of an individual eligible for targeting under the laws of war, meaning that under the law, a legitimate target has to represent a legitimate threat. The target has to be actively engaged in the hostilities in question to which the U.S. is party. And so it can't be a driver who's bringing milk to the fighters. It can't be the cousin who happens to live in the same compound with the fighter and is meeting him for dinner as he's done since they were little kids. No, I mean, in some cases under the laws of war, which are, you know, it's a very cold calculus. In some of those cases, you can be lawfully killed in a strike if you happen to be in the wrong place in the wrong time, and they call that acceptable collateral damage. But the question is, how many of these people who the U.S. is killing are actually being targeted, who are not collateral damage, but are being targeted, and the assumption is they are militants, simply because they may have friends or relatives who might be militants. And I know that sounds peculiar to an American audience, but in Yemen, in contrast to a place like Pakistan or Afghanistan, most members of Al-Qaeda's branch there, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, are Yemenis, and they're part of very tight-knit communities. So you might have in a single family someone who's a police officer, someone who is a merchant, and someone who's a member of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So the onus is on the U.S., actually, to sort out who's who, because under international law, if you're not sure who someone is, you have to assume they are a civilian. It's innocent until proven guilty under the laws of war, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. I found one of the quotes I was looking for was from the CIA. CIA official tells the New York Times, it bothers me when they say there were seven guys, so they must all be militants. They count the corpses, and they're not really sure who they are. They just say, look, if we kill them, then that was the guy we were trying to kill, and we would have only been trying to kill him if he was a bad guy, right? Even if it is just somebody's grandmother.
Exactly. And this is why we're also concerned about what we call these post-strike assessments, the post-strike review that the U.S. does after these strikes. They do count the bodies. They try to figure out who they killed. Did they get the person they were targeting and so forth? But our strong concern is that when the U.S. does post-strike assessments, that anybody who is a male of fighting age is just automatically considered to be a militant and put in the militant category. So it may not be that the U.S., in fact, is when the U.S. says civilian casualties are extremely rare, which is what they do say, it may be because they're putting anybody who's of male fighting age in the militant category, regardless of whether they're a fighter or not.
I got stuck on their paywall. I swear there's something in this piece where they talk about people being posthumously acquitted, basically, or found, you know, that not that they'll really investigate it, but that they claim to have a process for recognizing someone as an innocent if somehow they can be shown to be innocent after they're already dead. But anyway, I'm sorry. Well, if it's okay, Letta, I'd like to keep you through this break, just like a minute and a half or
sure.
something, and then come back and talk some more.
That sounds great. Thank
you. Okay, great. Hang on just one moment. It's Letta Taylor from HRW.org and foreignpolicy.com, The Price of War.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm in the middle of talking with Letta Taylor from Human Rights Watch. She's a terrorism researcher there, and she's got this new report, Between a Drone and Al-Qaeda, about the fate of Americans' collateral damage, civilian casualties in the drone war in Yemen. And again, she's got an article at foreignpolicy.com, which is dated yesterday, the 22nd of October, 2013, The Price of War. And I got to play devil's advocate a little bit with you here, nationalists advocate. I think you said under 100 strikes in the past, 5.5 years, 6 years, something like that.
Since 2009.
I'm sorry?
Yes, since 80 strikes since 2009.
Right.
In Yemen.
Uh-huh. In Yemen, right? And
yes.
And then dozens of civilian casualties. So if I could just pretend to be a Republican for a minute, I got to say, so what? Big deal. That's not very many innocent people killed under 100, and that's not very many strikes. You know, in fact, if they did 80 strikes and they only killed dozens of civilians, then they're doing a really, really good job with their counterterrorism scalpel and all of that kind of thing. And so it is bad for grandmothers and babies and children, but that's their bad luck for being near guys that our government absolutely has to kill to keep us all safe. What about all of that?
Well, I mean, I think there are elements of that argument that are quite sound. There's no doubt that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is a serious threat to the United States. They do want to put another would-be underwear bomber on a jet bound for the U.S., and they want it to work this time. That's what they tried in 2009. There's no question about that. There's also no question that drones themselves are very effective weapons, and we as an organization do not take a position against drones. We don't think drones are illegal weapons. We'll take a drone over a cluster bomb any day. Our issue, and as for numbers, if the numbers are small, fantastic. The problem is we have no idea how many civilians were really killed because there is this information blackout on the part of the government, a secrecy by the Obama administration, and of course by his predecessor, George W. Bush, that is untenable. The world has a right to know how many people were killed in these strikes and how many were civilians. And that's why we're calling for investigations, both by the Obama administration and by Congress, ideally the Intelligence and Armed Services Committee jointly, to find out just how many people have been killed. Because Is it the 53 people? Is it 53 civilians killed who I found to definitely have been unlawfully killed in two of the six strikes I detail? Is it hundreds? Is it somewhere in between? We don't even know. And part of the reason we don't know also is what you were just talking about with this post-strike analysis. Who's being put into what category? Are they legitimate targets or are they civilians? So all of these things matter. The other reason this matters is that to the American public, who may think, big deal, this is actually a pretty good ratio, is that there's a multiplier effect here. For every person killed wrongly in Yemen, hundreds of people then start hating the United States. This plays right into the hands of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
Well, and, you know, with what you were saying about the close-knit family structure there, it occurred to me that Faisal Shahzad, who was, in his own words, direct blowback from the drone strike program, not against Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, but against the Pakistani Taliban guys, where he was an American who went back home on vacation kind of thing, but an American citizen with a good job and a house and a wife and everything, and he went back to Pakistan and saw drone strikes, I guess, in his neighborhood or the aftermath of them anyway. And so he joined up the war on their side. But I can't think of anyone who did that because they felt bad that the Americans were killing Egyptian friends of Zawahiri in Pakistan. It was for bombing their people in Pakistan, Pakistanis in Pakistan. And
right.
So that's the kind of thing where I wonder how counterproductive it is. Perhaps, Letta, it's extremely counterproductive. And in fact, you know, maybe we're making way more enemies this way than we even imagine.
Well, this is the problem. We don't know for sure how many enemies we're making, but we do know for sure that we are making some and many. There is fear and there is anger against the U.S. for these strikes. And I think simply coming clean could actually lower the level of animosity considerably. If the U.S. would just say, look, okay, yeah, we killed 473 people in Yemen, or no, the media reports estimate 473, but actually it's 500 or 400, whatever it may be. And here's how many we think are civilians, and here's why they died. And we feel horrible about it, and we're doing our best to make amends, and this is why President Obama announced new policy guidelines to make these strikes safer. We're working on this all the time. But the transparency is so critical. For example, this is not Yemen, this is Pakistan, but the Pakistani government did recently tell a UN, a United Nations investigator, that they believe that the U.S. has killed, it was 400 and something civilians in drone strikes in the tribal areas of Pakistan. The U.S. refuses to confirm or deny that figure. This, again, plays into the hands of enemies of the U.S., whether it's people in the Pakistani government who want to discredit the U.S., whether it's groups like al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Everybody can jump on that silence as an admission of guilt on the part of the U.S. So really, if the U.S. hasn't killed that many civilians, that's great, and we're going to be very happy to hear that and to know that. But to know that, we need more information from the government, and that's why we're calling for investigations.
Yeah, well, are you making any progress as far as that? Are you getting much response? Is Congress going to hold a hearing or anything?
We've had a very there's been a lot of interest on Capitol Hill and within the Obama administration in hearing more about our report and our findings, and also how we came up with the findings. And I would like to mention that we cross-checked our information. We went through multiple sources. We visited sites when we could. When we couldn't, we sent trusted people we know who we've worked with for years, and in many cases more than one person independently to sites to clarify what was going on. So there's been a lot of interest in our findings and our methodology in the administration and on Capitol Hill among members of Congress. Will that lead to an investigation? We sure hope so, but it's too early to say. There's a lot of interest in keeping this information secret, I think, because it does give the U.S. Broad latitude. I don't want to suggest by that the U.S. is killing. We have no notion.
I'm sorry.
That the U.S.
I'm
is
sorry, Letta. I got to go. I got
to
go. It's
right.
Such great work. Foreignpolicy.com, HRW.org, y'all. Thanks again, Letta.
Letta
Taylor,
so
everybody. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Next up is Jason Leopold. Now he's writing for Press Freedom Foundation. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. Boy, your phone sounds terrible. Say something
I think
again.
That's always a problem with us, whenever we speak.
Yeah. I tell you what, you've got a good distinctive voice. I bet if you hold the microphone a little bit away, maybe it's the microphone
okay.
is blown.
How's that?
Maybe,
is that a
maybe.
Little better?
Yeah. I think we'll still be able to hear you fine, but we'll just try to keep your wind out of the mic. And
okay.
maybe that'll be it. It could be
okay,
more of an electronic thing, but I'm just not sure, honestly. Anyway, you still write for Al Jazeera, right?
I do. The Freedom of the Press Foundation, which is the crowdsourcing foundation in which Glenn Greenwald, John Cusack, Trevor Tim from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they started it to help fund transparency organizations and transparency efforts such as WikiLeaks and Center for Investigative Reporting, Muckrock News. I was one of the recipients for a crowdfunding grant. So every now and then I'll post something on their blog.
I get it.
Particularly on matters that relate to transparency.
Okay, right on. Well, and this is an important one. It's Clapper, the DNI, James Clapper, the felon, the guilty felon, as everyone in America agrees, 100% unanimously is guilty of felony perjury before Congress, which is a felony if somebody who's not the DNI does it. It is a felony. He's just in violation of it and getting away with it is all. He's the guy that Obama appointed to head the committee that's going to double check and make sure that they're doing a good job.
It's they'll tell you a different story. I mean, basically, you know, back in August when all of the revelations about the NSA's widespread surveillance started coming to a head, the stories that were published in the Washington Post and the Guardian, Obama held a news conference to discuss some of this. And he said during this news conference that he would take steps to try and win back trust, win back the public's trust. And some people took him seriously and others did not, just based on his track record. One of the things that he said that he would do is, call for an, quote, independent experts, a panel of experts, basically to get together to sort of scrutinize these NSA surveillance programs. And not long after that, maybe just a few days, we learned that the panel, the expert panel, would actually fall under the purview of the Office of Director of National Intelligence. And at first, it became sort of it was suggested that Clapper was going to have the oversight, that he was going to sort of head this independent panel, and the White House, as well as the Office of Director of National Intelligence, you know, they quickly tried to put out a statement saying no, that's not the case. He's just going to, quote, facilitate. Whatever that means, the work of this panel. Mm-hmm. But the outrage regarding that was as a result of the fact that which you pointed out, that he was lying to Congress not just once but several times, and he was forced to, quote, apologize for his erroneous statement. This panel sort of got together, and there was it clear that it was not an independent panel. You had Richard Clark on it, Cass Sunstein, Michael Morell, a former CIA official, so people who had very close ties to the administration. And what happened several weeks later, back in September, they had their first meeting, and the meeting was attended by civil liberties organizations, privacy groups, technology groups, but the public was not invited. Now, what the public probably was unaware of is that when Obama made this, when he called for for this panel to sort of be established, that essentially meant that it became an advisory committee. And an advisory committee means that it would have to fall under federal law, specifically the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And the Federal Advisory Committee Act, it's a 1972 law that more or less says that the work that these types of committees do should be objective, and the public should be able to attend meetings and check out their minutes. And see what they're up to. See what they're that they are doing, the work in an objective, transparent manner. And so when this committee started, this NSA review committee started to meet, so the technology groups went, the privacy and civil liberties groups went, but the public was not afforded the opportunity to attend, and that was sort of curious to me, particularly as I mentioned, because it should have fallen under this, this federal law. So several weeks later, on September 22nd, the Associated Press put together a pretty scathing report, just more or less said that this committee is not independent. It's simply an arm of, the administration. It's an arm of the Office of Director of National Intelligence. Even its formal name, which has Director of National Intelligence in it, shows that it's closely associated with, you know, the very same people who have not been forthcoming with Congress, lying to Congress. And that story in the Associated Press indicated that that Clapper had exempt the committee from following the provisions of the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And that was, you know, to me, that was like, whoa, that's a red flag right there. And naturally, as you know, Scott, what I do is I immediately filed a Freedom of Information Act request.
Right.
And I asked for the written determination that showed that this, in fact, this committee was exempt, that this committee did not have to follow those guidelines. I was very surprised that, you know, that I received a response quickly. In fact, it was just a couple of days ago that I received that response. And there it was. It was a one-page memo for the record signed by Clapper, which said that he was exempting this committee from the Federal Advisory Committee Act due to national security concerns, meaning that none of their minutes, any records or documents could not be shared with the public because it may pose a national, you know, it may danger national security. And what was very interesting to me, however, was the date that he signed this. It was September 19th. As I indicated, the Associated Press published their story on September 22nd. And you know as well as I do, and you know the world of journalism, you're working on a story, you're probably working on it, you know, for more than 3 days, particularly if you're getting a bunch of comments and you're doing interviews and you're trying to chase down information. Uh-huh. So, I mean, I don't have any evidence, but it certainly seems to suggest that, you know, the Associated Press asked some questions about whether this committee was open, was opening its doors to the public, and if not, why not? And Clapper, you know, issued this memo, basically exempting them. And, you know, it's important to also note that the law, it was back in 2010 in the intelligence bill that Congress, actually, the Senate Intelligence Committee, this was backed by Dianne Feinstein and other members, that they slipped in an amendment into the intelligence bill that authorized specifically the Office of Director of National Intelligence, authorized them to exempt any advisory committees from following the provisions of the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And they're the only government agency that actually has that authorization. So, I mean, the CIA and, believe it or not, the Federal Reserve have a blanket waiver. So
they don't
have to follow it at all. But so it's interesting, and it's also, you know, important to note that that is likely the reason that this committee, this NSA review committee, was placed under the purview of the Office of Director of National Intelligence, so none of its work would be scrutinized. And, you know, once again, you know, the statements that the president makes about transparency, they're just, you know, these empty statements that are meaningless.
Well, but what I don't understand, what work are they even doing that he's got to keep from you if he says himself it's not classified, which is in effect saying he's perjuring himself when he says it must be kept secret on the other hand. But and this whole thing is just to goof around PR stunt anyway, right? I mean, what's the big deal?
It's exactly what it is. And I think that it's, you know, that certainly, you know, become clear. And in fact, there was no discussion, as far as we know, of any classified material in these, you know, in these open, you know, in these open meetings.
Right.
Or rather, these meetings that were attended by, you know, the civil liberties group. So
right. In other words, like, that would be the only argument that they have, right? Is, well, listen, we had to really break down how Blarney works to the people at you know, EFF, whatever, just
right.
whoever they put on their committee to Richard Clark, hardly EFF. We had to tell him very, very top secret classified things so that we would be able to assess what to do about it. They're not even doing that. They're not even pretending to do that. They're only talking about the stuff that's basically already in the paper and not going beyond that. Maybe right. not even and going that far, right?
That's exactly correct. So then the question just becomes, why? And I think it's, you know, like I said, you know, Congress gave them the, you know, gave them the authority to do this, so they're doing it. And, you know, once again, the public just gets shut out of having any sort of, you know, meaningful discussion that, you know, President Obama promised with regard to this. So, again, you know, you have this secret so-called independent panel supposedly scrutinizing these, you know, these surveillance programs. Nobody knows what they're doing. The report that they're supposed to release, or the interim report, was supposed to be released this month. The final report's at the end of the year. We don't even know when we'll get to see that. So, as you said, it all comes down to, or it certainly looks like, just a giant PR stunt.
Well, now, the groups, the actual interest groups that were allowed to attend that one meeting anyway, they reported pretty thoroughly what happened there, right? So what difference does it make to you, and what difference does it make to Clapper?
Well, when you say what difference does it make to me, I mean, let me tell you what I was interested in just as a journalist. I wanted to see their minutes. I wanted to see, you know, records that they passed out, reports, you know, to be able to report on it. And I think the public would actually want to know exactly, you know, what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. Clapper clearly just doesn't want anything discussed. Even if it's not classified, he doesn't want anything discussed. You know, the NSA, up until, you know, the revelations started to surface in June, enjoyed quite a bit of secrecy. I mean, you know, you would never get a phone call back, you know, from their office other than, you know, no comment on this, you know, any specific program. So here, the, you know, the agency is under quite a bit of scrutiny, and they're continuing to go out of their way to, you know, essentially conceal whatever it is that they're doing from the public.
I mean, right, and make it more and more obvious that they're exactly the kind of people who need to be reined in and not trusted with this kind of power, when the whole theory here is that a bunch of free people allow them to be our security force rather than
right.
we're their subjects and they get to tell us what to do all day like in the old world.
Right. I mean, it's funny that excuse me, that they actually had the you know, the Director of National Intelligence, you know, Clapper's office put out this Tumblr. If you recall that, it was IC on the record or ICON the record, and it was this effort to try to be transparent, where, you know, they placed some of the documents that they recently declassified. But, you know, if you have an advisory committee, I mean, think of it almost as your city council, and it's open to the public. You know, the public perhaps will get a chance to comment. They'll get to see what, you know, what's being discussed. There's a Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, and they have access to classified material, and they discuss classified material. And, you know, those hearings that they have are, you know, are open to the public as well. They are open to the public. So it's strange that he issued this. And as I said, the timing is coincidental. I mean, 3 days before this Associated Press report comes out, and, you know, the question just boils down to, like, why, and why is he doing this? But it's just another example of, you know, this rampant secrecy and these meaningless promises that the you know, that about transparency that the president makes.
Yep. All right, everybody, check it out. It's Jason Leopold at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. The website is Press Freedom Foundation. Oi. The article is, Clapper Memo Reveals Rationale Behind NSA Review Group Secrecy. Good work, as always. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you, Scott. Have a good one.
You too. All right, everybody, we'll be right back in just a sec with our good friend Arlo Pignatti. Where's my audio? There it is. To the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And next up is our friend Arlo Pignatti. He runs CommodityDiscs.com. CommodityDiscs.com. And yeah, welcome back to the show. How's it going?
Hi, Scott. Thanks again for having me on. Love being on your show.
Well, good. Very happy to have you here. And you know what? I'm very excited still to this day. I get all amped up and my mannerisms, my arms start flailing around and all this stuff, because I was just earlier today describing about Commodity Disc to a friend, and I noticed, wow, look at me. I'm all excited and flailing my arms as I speak and stuff. I just think it's the coolest thing in the whole freaking world. This is the future of mankind. As long as you can get the word out, as long as everybody can know, hey, that's a thing? Wow. Then I think that this is going to be the one world currency of the future, and there will be no central bank or police state involved. It's just a 1 ounce piece of pure silver, and it's got a QR code on the back so that you can judge its price instantaneously with the smartphone that pretty much everybody, at least in North America and Europe, already has with the smartphone and the free app there. So I think it is so cool. And tell them all about it. You can say all the same things I just said if you need to. Get them excited about it. And then at the end, I'm going to give them a pitch why they ought to donate to me and get one.
Yeah, no, your little description there, I mean, that covers most of it. I mean, that's the great thing about it is it's really simple. I think it's a real simple solution to using silver as money. You know, if I didn't do it, someone would have thought of it. I'm the first to mint the first 1,000 silver pieces, and I've sold almost, or exchanged almost half of them. And so what's great is, you know, even if not literally everybody has a smartphone yet, but between the person spending and the merchant accepting, hopefully one will have a smartphone, and then they just scan it and they see the spot price plus suggested, manufacturer's added trade value to cover the cost of minting it and shipping it.
By the way, is a smartphone the only way to take a picture of the QR code, or do they have QR code readers at stores and stuff like that, or how's that work?
QR code readers are kind of obsolete now. I think anyone who's stocking goods or shelves in the back, you know, might have a QR code reader, but they wouldn't really encounter the currency. Of course, anyone who has a QR code reader that they use at their workplace, they may want to, you know, start keeping them up with the cashier if we can get these things circulating enough for it to be commonplace. Now we're just
I see people driving around with QR codes on the back of their car and stuff. It seems like this is starting to catch on. I don't know what happens if you take the picture. I never tried it. I was driving at the time, but
Yeah, I think more people than not at least know how to use QR codes to begin with. So that's great. They're familiar with it. They already have it. You know, most people already have an app. And if you don't, it's free. You know, I recommend an app like Google Goggles is a good one, because that also doubles as a way to sort of Google images that you take with your phone. So you can point it at a certain type of, say, plant or a flower. It'll match it up with similar images to find what you're looking at.
Wow, that's cool. So what app is that?
It's called Google Goggles. Not to be confused with Google Glass, but it's Google Goggles, and it's just a simple little free app you can install on your phone. And that's the one I used to test my currency, because I knew it was, you know, it was a common app that many people have.
Right. Well, you know, I just went to the app store. I'm not all that fancy and sophisticated at the apps and this and that, but I just got a plain old QR code reader here on my phone. It works great. You know, I just, in fact, I was showing it to my friend this morning, and it went straight to your website and told me that the price of silver is $22 and something cents, right?
Yeah, right now, $22.66. And so, you know,
and, you know, in the future, pretty soon, you'll be able to go ahead and compare to euros or won or yen or whatever you want, right? Gold? How many fractions of an ounce of gold can you buy with 1 ounce of silver, that kind of thing?
See, what I'm going to do is, for every 1,000 pieces I exchange, and so there's, it costs maybe spot price plus maybe around $4 to break even on this. So I'm exchanging them at spot plus $5, so I can at least raise $1 for every piece exchanged to go towards improving the currency itself. And so, like, what I'd like to do is, you know, maybe about every 1,000 pieces or so, I'm going to add a new function to it. And one of the first functions I would like to have is to where when you scan it with your phone, it can detect what country you're in. So if you are in England, it will convert to pounds. If you are in, you know, any of the European countries, using the euro, compete to euros, and so on.
Excellent.
And I've already had people in England and Australia and Japan interested in that. So it's pretty cool to think that I, you know, as soon as I launch that, I have people in other countries using it.
Yeah. Well, listen, silver's been currency in one form or another for about 6,000 years or more, something like that. It's shiny. It's a pure element thing. It's pretty easy to divide, and girls like it on their fingers, and so guys like it because girls like it. And so it's always going to be valued at some price, depending on your local currency. And it's always been some kind of currency, it seems like, especially the history in America with the Spanish silver dollar becoming the de facto currency of America for so long in the beginning there, that it's just such a cool thing. It, you know, it takes the power away from those who would print money and force you at gunpoint to accept it. And I like that. And so anyway, it's the greatest thing, man. I sure hope that this takes off. And, you know, at $1 over your costs, you make $1 billion doing this thing and get these out, because I just think it's the greatest idea in the world. And I hope everybody copies you too. I mean, what's the problem? Everybody mint coins and put a QR code thing that tells you the instant spot price on. It's the greatest thing in the world. Sorry, but it's don't mean to take all your give your thing away. You still invented it, but wouldn't that be great if that was just what everybody used, with silver coins and paper receipts that really meant you could get your silver coin and you weren't relying on the government to come through for you, you know?
And, you know, what I love about having this, and now that I actually have it in production, I can hold it in my hand, I love showing it off. And it's not only an educational tool to spark discussion with people about what's wrong with legal tender and why this is better, but it also connects me with others who they already know. I meet more and more owners of businesses who totally get it, that why we should have money backed in something real, and that's great to make those connections. So, you know, everybody should have one of these with them and just show it off when they spend their money. And if somebody doesn't understand it or doesn't want it, all right, fine, give them, you know, just give them regular, you know, regular dollars. But you get to see who gets it and who doesn't. And for people who will accept our silver commodity discs, I will put them on every directory, including our upcoming Silver Pages directory, so get them in touch with the consumers who want to spend it.
There you go. All right, that's Arlo Pignotti, commoditydiscs.com and facebook.com/commodity discs. Thanks, Arlo.
Thanks.
And if you donate $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show, you get one in the mail. That's scotthorton.org/donate. You know, if you like the show.